Okay, let's unpack this. Here's something that really makes you stop and think. A whopping 73% of social science postgraduate programs in Mexico don't require any mandatory logic courses.
73%. Wow. That's significant.
That's from REDMEX, the Mexican Network of Postgraduate Programs in Social Sciences, back in 2022. It makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
What happens when the very foundation, you know, the way we try to understand society might have some, well, some cracks in it.
It definitely raises questions about the robustness of the reasoning, the fundamental assumptions behind social research, especially in Mexico.
Yeah.
It sort of suggests a potential vulnerability, maybe, to conclusions that aren't fully supported.
Exactly. And that's precisely what we're diving deep into today. We've got our hands on a fascinating document. It's basically brand new, Logica Absurda y Contra Epistemologías, Crítica Filosófica, Metodológica y Política de la Investigación Social in Mexico.
Okay.
It's by Carlos Medel Ramirez, just out April 2025. And listen, this isn't just some, you know, dry academic paper.
Right.
It's a really critical look at how research in Mexico can get, well, distorted by things like lingering colonial influences, flawed methods, hidden biases.
And those distortions can have real-world impacts.
Totally. They ultimately affect real issues on the ground.
And what's compelling here is the author's goal, right? He's not just pointing fingers.
No.
He seems to be calling for a kind of fundamental rethink of how social research is done and interpreted in Mexico.
And that's where it gets really interesting for you, our listener. You want to get informed quickly, thoroughly, but without feeling, you know, buried in jargon.
Mm.
So our mission today is to take these core arguments from Medel Ramirez and really break them down. We want to show how they challenge the usual ways of thinking
about social research.
Yeah. And why this matters for anyone trying to get a handle on the complexities of Mexico today. Expect some surprising insights, maybe some aha moments.
And connecting it to the bigger picture, this deep dive offers a crucial lens, really, for evaluating information coming out of Mexico.
Right.
It pushes for a more critical, more nuanced understanding, something beyond just surface level takes.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Medel Ramirez kicks things off looking at the philosophical groundwork, you know, classical logic, Aristotle.
Ah, the foundations, non-contradiction, identity, the excluded middle.
Exactly. Those principles.
Yeah.
The idea was they'd help social scientists build strong, coherent arguments, avoid flawed reasoning.
Right. The basic toolkit for clear thinking when studying society, like the classic syllogism.
Yeah, like all men are mortal.
Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. That kind of basic structure.
But here's where the absurd logic, as the author calls it, starts creeping in. He brings up a 2019 IND report, that's the National Statistics Institute,
okay,
that linked poverty in Chiapas with domestic violence. Now, okay, intuitively, maybe that sounds plausible.
You can see the surface connection.
But Medel Ramirez argues, drawing on that statistic about logic training, that this is a classic case of overlooking multiple causes.
Ah, okay, so simplifying too much.
Exactly. You can't just point the finger at poverty without also looking at, you know, access to justice in the region or the huge influence of organized crime, other major factors.
That example really highlights the danger, doesn't it? Drawing these overly simple sort of A causes B conclusions when social reality is just much messier.
Right. And then we get into postmodern thinkers, people like Lyotard.
Okay.
They start questioning if this classical logic is really as universal as it's made out to be. They suggest it can become a kind of hegemonic rationality.
Hegemonic rationality, like one dominant way of thinking that pushes out other valid perspectives.
Yeah, precisely. Lyotard argues this dominant logic can end up imposing its way of understanding onto, say, local diverse knowledge systems, even if they have their own logic.
So it's a challenge to the idea of a single objective truth with a capital T.
Mm-hmm.
Lyotard and others are saying, look, different knowledge systems might operate with their own internal logics, their own ways of making sense of the world.
And Medel Ramirez uses the example of traditional indigenous medicine in Mexico to illustrate this.
Well, so...
Well, he points out how it's often been dismissed, sometimes just because it doesn't fit neatly into Western scientific methods. Toledo made this point back in 2015, too.
That really throws a spotlight on potential colonial bias, doesn't it? Even within supposedly objective science.
Yeah.
Different cultures have developed really sophisticated, effective knowledge systems that just don't align with Western protocols.
And then you get this contrasting view from Mignolo, from his work in 2000.
Yeah.
He goes even further.
Okay.
He argues Aristotelian logic isn't just one logic, but actually a tool of coloniality, something imposed.
Wow. A tool of coloniality.
Yeah. And he contrasts it with what he calls indigenous relational logic, suggesting a fundamentally different way of seeing connections, cause, and effect.
Mignola's view really forces you to think about how even our most basic intellectual tools might be tangled up with power structures and, well, historical domination.
Okay. From there, the deep dive moves into Kant. His ideas about the limits of our reason.
Ah, Kant, theoretical versus practical reason.
Right, and that concept of transcendental illusion.
Which is basically when we try to use abstract thought to create perfect systems, often ignoring the messy reality on the ground.
Exactly. Trying to reason our way to utopia, maybe overlooking the contradictions.
Kant was really cautioning against that overreach of pure theory into areas where experience and context are just paramount.
And Mena Ramirez brings up AMLO's Refundación de la República, this idea of fundamentally remaking the Republic as a potential modern example of this transcendental illusion.
Interesting. So the idea of designing a perfect society through grand plans, perhaps without fully grappling with deep-rooted historical issues.
Kind of like that, yeah. It's a lens to analyze these big political projects that might, you know, overpromise or not fully account for the complexities of change.
Right.
And this isn't just abstract theory having no effect. The author points to the Sembrando Vida program.
Ah, the tree planting and anti-poverty program.
Yeah, intended to tackle poverty and climate change. But according to a CNDH report in 2023, that's the National Human Rights Commission, it actually ended up causing land conflicts in Chiapas.
Why?
Because it applied this one-size-fits-all approach, apparently, without considering local specifics, local traditions.
Oof. That's a concrete example of the danger of imposing standardized solutions without understanding the diverse local realities. Ignoring those messy contradictions has real consequences.
Okay, next up. Foucault. His concept of regimes of truth.
Ah, Foucault. The idea that power and knowledge are deeply intertwined.
Exactly. Power structures don't just suppress truth, they actively produce what we accept as true.
Right. Understanding these regimes helps us see how certain stories become dominant, widely believed, while others get pushed to the margin.
Meta Ramirez analyzes the official story around public security in Mexico, that whole war against the narco narrative. He argues it effectively normalized the militarization of the country. Even though, get this, a GIEI report in 2023 found that 68% of human rights violations were committed by the armed forces themselves.
68%? That's staggering. It shows how a powerful narrative can shape public opinion and justify actions, even when the evidence points to serious negative consequences.
He also unpacks that common phrase, el que nada debe, nada teme.
He who owes nothing fears nothing. Yeah, you hear that a lot.
Right. Used by past presidents. Meta Ramirez argues it created this false binary. Like, if you're innocent, you've got no reason to fear state power.
Which completely ignores the reality for, say, families of the disappeared.
Exactly. They often had very legitimate reasons to fear speaking out, to fear demanding justice. But that phrase kind of implies that fear itself is suspicious.
Yeah, it's subtle but powerful. It can silence victims by creating this climate of suspicion.
Then we shift focus to Enrique Dussel and his philosophy of liberation, a really important voice from Latin America critiquing Eurocentrism.
Dussel is foundational for decolonial thought, isn't he? Advocating for a real dialogue between different knowledge systems, moving beyond just the Western perspective.
And the author gives this great example. The Purépecha community rejecting Canadian mining projects.
Okay.
The companies came in with their standard Eurocentric indicators. Development, progress, you know.
Right, the usual metrics.
But the community rejected it based on their concept of buen vivir.
Buen vivir, good living. A more holistic understanding of well-being.
Exactly. Including their relationship with the land, their culture. It's a total clash of worldviews right there.
That perfectly illustrates the tension, doesn't it, between those Western ideas of economic development and indigenous cosmologies that prioritize communal well-being, connection to nature.
But it's not all negative examples. Meta Ramirez also points to the Universidad Autónoma Indígena de México, UAM, in Sinaloa.
What are they doing?
They're actively integrating ancestral knowledge and indigenous languages into their curriculum.
That's fantastic. A concrete step towards decolonizing education, taking indigenous knowledge seriously within the formal system.
And just to hammer home the point about this ongoing dependence on outside ideas.
Yeah.
Remember that Red Mech statistic. 80% of theories cited in Mexican theses are European.
80%. Still, that really puts Dussel's call to decolonize reason into perspective, doesn't it?
It really does. It shows how much work there still is to do to diversify the theoretical toolkit in Mexican academia.
Yeah, and consciously engage with more perspectives from the global south.
Okay, let's switch gears slightly. Let's talk about rhetoric, specifically logical fallacies.
The tools of persuasion and sometimes manipulation.
Right. Manuel Ramirez points out they aren't just accidental mistakes in logic. They can be very deliberate, very effective persuasive tactics.
Exactly. They can sound convincing even when they're logically unsound. Recognizing them is key to critical thinking.
He gives this example that sounds almost paradoxical. Someone saying, look, we disagree with your ideology, but we defend your freedom of expression.
Okay, sounds reasonable on the surface.
But when it's used, say, against feminists to shut down their actual concerns, the author calls it a performative paradox. It's like tolerating them in a way that avoids actually engaging with their critique, silencing through tolerance almost.
That's subtle. Using the language of free speech to actually mask power dynamics and dodge the substance of the argument.
Then there's a more straightforward case. Claudio X. Gonzalez saying that criticisms of NGOs are just part of a plot to weaken democracy.
The ad hominem fallacy. Attacking the critic instead of the criticism.
Exactly. It's circular reasoning, right? Mm-hmm. It deflects from the actual issues being raised by trying to discredit the source.
And avoids any real engagement. Yeah.
And these fallacies aren't just word games. They can have serious policy consequences. The author points to the false dilemma used to push the 2017 Ley de Seguridad Interior.
The internal security law. What was the dilemma?
Basically, the argument was, either we give the state these broad security powers, or Mexico descends into total chaos. A false choice.
Right, presenting only two extreme options when others exist.
And ironically, or maybe predictably, data from the SNSP, the public security system, actually showed an increase in extrajudicial executions after the law was passed.
Oof. That's a chilling example of how flawed political rhetoric can lead to policies with devastating human rights consequences.
Okay, moving on. The deep dive looks at dialectics, the idea of contradiction, central to Marxist thought.
Right, the idea that tension and conflict, like between capital and labor, drive social change.
But Meadow Ramirez also brings in Adorno's caution here.
Adorno's warning against applying dialectics too rigidly, too dogmatically.
Exactly. Don't turn it into a simplistic formula that ignores complexity.
Yeah, that's important.
In Mexico, the author mentions maquiladora strikes in Tijuana as a pretty clear example of that classic capital labor contradiction.
Those export processing zones really highlight the ongoing tensions and power imbalances.
But then a more nuanced case, the 2013 energy reform.
Okay, which was widely criticized by the left as neoliberal.
Right. But interestingly, it also inadvertently created space for some communities in Oaxaca to develop their own wind power projects.
Huh. So a policy with seemingly negative aspects overall had some unexpected positive outcomes for certain groups.
Yeah, it shows that contradictions aren't always purely antagonistic. Things can be complex, outcomes mixed.
It demonstrates that social phenomena rarely fit into neat boxes.
And the feminist perspective adds another crucial layer. Sylvia Federici expands dialectics to include social reproduction.
All that unpaid labor caregiving housework that keeps society running.
Exactly. And the statistic he cites is powerful. 78% of domestic workers in Mexico, mostly lacking social security, are indigenous women.
Wow. That stunkily shows the intersection of class, gender, and ethnicity in these hidden forms of labor and exploitation.
It really broadens the picture beyond just the factory floor.
Absolutely. It reveals how economic, social, and reproductive labor are all interconnected and tied into systems of oppression.
Okay, final point in this philosophical section. Analogies.
Analogies. Useful tools, but potentially dangerous if misused.
Right. They can make complex ideas easier to grasp by comparing them to something familiar.
But the strength of the comparison is key, and avoiding oversimplification is crucial.
Meadow Ramirez gives a really harmful historical example, using Herbert Spencer's Survival of the Fittest.
Oh, dear. Social Darwinism.
Yeah, using that to justify cuts to social spending in Mexico.
Yeah.
The argument being, essentially, the poor are unproductive, so why support them?
That's a deeply problematic misuse of a biological concept to justify social inequality and neglect.
He contrasts that with Kropotkin, who emphasized cooperation, not just competition, in evolution.
Kropotkin's focus on mutual aid.
Right. And he gives the example of traditional barter systems still active in places like Michoacan, showing cooperation in practice.
It's a valuable counter-narrative, highlighting that cooperation is just as fundamental, if not more so, than competition in human societies.
We saw this with pandemic analogies too, didn't we? Hugo Lopez-Gatell, the health spokesperson, often framed it as a war.
Right, the war metaphor, which tends to imply a need for top-down, centralized, maybe even authoritarian control.
But Judith Butler argued against that. She suggested epidemics require solidarity, collective care, not military discipline.
Two very different framings with very different implications. The war demands obedience. Solidarity demands mutual support and care.
Even in economics, think about the metaphor, the market is an organism.
Yeah, that's pervasive. It implies natural balance, self-regulation.
And it underpins narratives like TMEC will cure the Mexican economy, often glossing over power imbalances or negative side effects. Donalo's pointed this out recently.
It shows how these deep-seated metaphors shape our understanding and influence policy debates, often masking complexity.
But analogies aren't always bad. They can be used critically, too. The EZLN naming their currency El Caracol, the snail.
Ah, yes, a brilliant metaphor.
For slow, deliberate, patient, community-driven resistance, as Esteva noted.
It perfectly captures their philosophy, rejecting quick fixes and emphasizing organic change.
So, wrapping up this whole philosophical dive,
yeah.
What's the big takeaway?
Well, Mel Ramirez seems to be arguing that this absurd logic isn't just an academic curiosity.
Yeah.
It's deeply tied to political power, historical legacies like colonialism, current forces like neoliberalism, and this kind of intellectual centralization that often sidelines other ways of knowing.
He does offer some potential paths forward, though, right? Reforming education, supporting critical journalism.
Yeah, training in logic and decolonial perspectives, prioritizing research that involves communities and shaping policy, that kind of thing.
It kind of reminds me of that Eduardo Galeano quote about utopia being on the horizon. It keeps you walking.
That's a good way to put it. The core message seems to be the need for a major shift in how knowledge and reasoning are approached in Mexican social sciences.
A conscious effort to decolonize thinking, challenge biases.
And embrace more critical, context-aware ways of understanding Mexican realities.
Yeah. All right. So we've dug into the philosophical roots. Now let's pivot in section two to how these issues actually play out in the methods used in social research in Mexico.
Right. How does the critique of the underlying philosophy translate into questioning the actual tools and techniques researchers use?
Metal Ramirez talks about the decolonial turn in methodology. This is influenced by thinkers like Quijano and Mignola.
Challenging those dominant Eurocentric methods that often ignored or erased local and indigenous knowledge.
Exactly. He points to CSIS, the Center for Research and Higher Studies in Social Anthropology, as an institution trying to change that.
How are they doing it?
By adopting more participatory approaches when working with indigenous communities, actually valuing things like oral histories, traditional ceremonies, community practices as legitimate knowledge.
That's a key shift, isn't it? Recognizing that valuable knowledge exists outside formal academia, within the lived experiences and cultural practices of communities.
He gives a specific example from Waka research on traditional mixed medicine. They intentionally combined standard ethnographic interviews with something called tequios.
Tequios, that's like communal work, reciprocal exchange.
Yeah. So validating traditional herbal knowledge alongside biomedical approaches, but doing it within the community's own practices.
That shows a move away from extractive research, just taking data, towards more collaborative, reciprocal models where community knowledge is central.
Now, it's not all perfectly harmonious. Sousa Santos offers a note of caution.
What's his concern?
He suggests there's a risk of romanticizing indigenous cultures sometimes, maybe overlooking internal complexities or conflicts within those communities.
That's a fair point. Need for nuance even within decolonial approaches. Avoid creating idealized images and acknowledge internal diversity.
But then, on the flip side, Leyva argues that truly collaborative research, like in Chiapas with the Zapatistas, has actually strengthened their autonomy.
So research done ethically in partnership can be a tool for empowerment and self-determination.
That's the argument. When it serves the community's goals, it can be transformative.
Interesting tension there.
Okay, next up, ethics. Moving beyond just getting a signature on a consent form.
Oh, yeah. Ethics in social research is huge. It's way more than just informed consent. Reciprocity, potential harm, community benefit. It's complex.
Metal Ramirez shares a worrying example from a study on gender violence in Ecatepec.
What happened?
The research apparently increased stigma for the women involved by labeling them mainly as victims, but then didn't provide any real follow-up support.
Ouch. That highlights the danger of unintended harm. Researchers need to be so careful about language and ensure support mechanisms are in place.
He brings in Tronto's ethics of care here, emphasizing ongoing responsibility, not just a one-off transaction.
A relational approach to ethics.
Yeah. And he mentions UNAM, the big national university, now has a protocol requiring researchers to plan how they'll actually share findings and give back to the communities.
That points towards a more community-centered ethic, prioritizing well-being throughout the whole process, from design to dissemination.
This all echoes Linda Tuhiwai-Smith's argument in Decolonizing Methodologies, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Her core point is that research should serve the communities being studied, not just extract data for academic careers, fundamentally challenging those historical power imbalances.
Okay, let's tackle the quantitative-qualitative divide, that old chestnut. Still seems pretty polarized in Mexico.
Ah, yes, the quant-qual wars. Numbers versus narratives, breadth versus depth. It's a persistent debate in the social sciences everywhere, really.
Metal Ramirez contrasts Inegi's focus on big national surveys with something like the Jóvenes Construyendo el Futuro program.
Youth Building the Future.
Yeah, which used digital ethnographies to get a richer sense of young unemployed people's experiences. Very different approaches.
Reflects different goals, right?
Yeah.
Quant often aims for generalizability, identifying broad trends. Quan seeks deep contextual understanding of specific experiences.
He touches on the positivist view, like Kanapo's marginalization index, all based on measurable indicators.
Positivism, seeking objective, measurable facts, general laws.
Versus more interpretivist critiques, like with feminicides, where just counting bodies misses the whole systemic picture, as Marcelo Lagarde argues.
Interpretivism, focusing on subjective meanings, understanding how people make sense of their world.
But there are efforts to bridge this gap. The Atlas de los Pueblos Indígenas.
The Atlas of Indigenous Peoples.
Yeah, that combines critical cartography, challenging traditional maps, with testimonies in indigenous languages.
That sounds like a powerful example of integration, fusing different kinds of data and knowledge to get a much richer, more nuanced picture. Methodological innovation.
Another key alternative method highlighted is Participatory Action Research, IAP.
Ah, PAR. Based on Frere and Falls-Borda, empowering communities by involving them directly in the research.
Exactly. From defining the questions to analyzing data and taking action, it's about co-creation of knowledge.
A fundamentally collaborative approach aimed at producing action that benefits the community.
He gives a great example from Iztapalapa in Mexico City. Community members and researchers worked together on diagnosing contaminated water issues.
And what was the outcome?
It actually led to the local government stepping in and installing water filters. Real, tangible change driven by the research.
That's PAR working as intended, empowering communities to identify and solve their own problems, leading to concrete improvements.
But it's not always smooth sailing. He mentions a case of academic paternalism in Guerrero.
Where the researchers may be aimed for participation but still held all the real power?
Seems like it. He contrasts that with the Tlaloc Network in Puebla, where women themselves designed anti-domestic violence policies based on their own research.
That contrast really underscores how crucial genuine collaboration and equitable power sharing are for PAR to be truly empowering. It's about partnership, not just consultation.
Then the crucial concept of intersectionality, Kimberly Crenshaw's framework.
Right. Understanding how different forms of oppression, race, gender, class, etc., don't just add up. They intersect and interact, creating unique experiences.
It's not just additive, it's multiplicative, almost.
Yeah, it creates compounded disadvantage, a vital analytical lens.
Metal Ramirez uses that statistic again. 65% of indigenous domestic workers in Mexico lack healthcare access.
That powerfully illustrates intersectionality in action, ethnicity, class, and gender, all converging to create extreme vulnerability.
And groups like the Frente Indígena de Mujeres Migrantes are using this lens.
The Indigenous Front of Migrant Women.
To analyze how migration to the U.S. specifically impacts indigenous women, layering on another dimension of vulnerability.
Applying that intersectional analysis to understand complex, multi-layered realities, important work.
Now, there is some debate around intersectionality itself. Maria Lagones raised a critique.
What was her point?
She suggested that sometimes the way intersectionality is applied might inadvertently impose Western categories onto local struggles in the global South, maybe missing nuances.
A critical perspective worth considering. How do we ensure these powerful frameworks don't become another form of intellectual imposition?
And the response, Metal Ramirez notes, is the emergence of things like community feminism in Oaxaca.
How does that differ?
It actively integrates indigenous spirituality and connection to territory into its analysis of gender and power, making intersectionality more grounded in their specific context.
Adapting an evolving theory to be more culturally attuned. That makes sense.
Okay, data reliability. Another huge challenge. Corruption. Access issues. It really affects how trustworthy the data is.
Absolutely fundamental. If the data is shaky, the research built on it is shaky. And the policies based on that research are definitely shaky. A huge problem in context with corruption or limited transparency.
He points to conflicting homicide figures from 2022. Government reports a decrease, but independent groups like Semaphore Delictivo, using different sources, show an increase.
Big discrepancies like that raise serious red flags about official data accuracy and transparency, underscores the need for independent verification.
Plus, the 2020 census reportedly missed about 1.2 million people, mostly in marginalized areas, according to Carnival.
A 1.2 million undercount. That has massive implications for resource allocation, policy planning. If people aren't counted, their needs are invisible.
And Metal Ramirez brings in Sally Mary's point about global indicators.
Her argument that countries sometimes adopt international metrics for rights or progress,
but more for show, for superficial compliance, rather than driving real change on the ground.
Exactly. The risk of symbolic adoption without substantive implementation. Checking boxes versus making a difference.
Finally, in this methods section, digital technologies. A double-edged sword.
For sure. Huge potential, but also significant challenges. Oh, access, right. Bias, ethics.
On one hand, big data, AI, could revolutionize research. But then the digital divide, 38% of Mexicans lack internet access, according to EDG.
That immediately raises equity issues. Who gets included in digital research? Who benefits? It risks deepening existing inequalities.
And the author mentions Data Civica, using algorithms to map gender violence. Useful, but...
But if the algorithms are trained on biased police data.
Exactly. They can end up just reproducing, even amplifying those biases.
Algorithmic bias is a critical issue. Garbage in, garbage out, or worse, biased data in, discriminatory outputs out.
So you have this tension. Optimists like Saskia Sassen seem potential for democratizing knowledge.
Versus critics like Shoshana Zuboff warning about surveillance capitalism.
Yeah, and the alleged use of Mexico City's C5 surveillance data to potentially criminalize protests. Very different perspectives on the technology.
Reflects the broader societal debate, doesn't it? The potential versus the perils of these powerful digital tools.
So, wrapping up this method section, what's the core argument?
It seems to be a call for a fundamental shift away from just importing global research models.
Right.
Towards developing methodologies that are more locally relevant, ethically sound, critically engaged, and really responsive to the Mexican context.
And he suggests concrete steps. Training in PAR and decolonial approaches, citizen audits of data.
Stronger alliances between academics and communities, ensuring research actually serves people's needs.
Yeah. It makes you think of that Falls Borda quote, "Knowledge is not power. It is liberation only when shared."
Exactly. It's pushing for research in Mexico to be more reflexive, more ethical, and actively contribute to social justice and community empowerment, not just academic papers.
Okay, we've covered the philosophy, we've covered the methods. Now for our final section, let's zoom out to the wider sociopolitical landscape. Who gets to decide what counts as knowledge in Mexico? What are the power dynamics?
Right. This connects everything back to the broader social, political, and economic forces that inevitably shape how knowledge is produced, circulated, and validated. The interplay of power and knowledge.
Metal Ramirez starts with Gramsci's concept of hegemony.
Ah, Gramsci. How dominant groups maintain power not just through force, but by shaping ideas and beliefs, making their worldview seem like common sense.
Precisely. He uses the example of government-issued free textbooks. Important, yes, but they might also subtly shape historical narratives.
Emphasizing certain events, downplaying or omitting others, like the Catalalco massacre, maybe?
Exactly. As Pugnatausa documented, it shows how institutions like education can subtly reinforce dominant ideologies.
Hegemony in action.
He also discusses the role of the big media duopoly, Televisa and TV Azteca, for many years.
Their influence was huge, wasn't it?
Immense. And they often push this narrative of a modern Mexico, which sometimes glossed over deep inequalities and issues.
Right.
And get this statistic. 78% of security news coverage between 2010 and 2018 just repeated official government statements uncritically.
78%. That highlights the power of media to shape discourse and the danger when critical, independent journalism is lacking. official narratives can go unchallenged.
But crucially, there's always resistance. He points to the Universidad de la Tierra in Chiapas, run by the EZLNN.
The University of the Earth, a fascinating initiative.
Totally. Using anti-positivist methods, validating knowledge in community assemblies, prioritizing indigenous languages, it's a fundamentally different model.
A powerful example of a grassroots challenge to dominant Western ways of knowing, rooted in local needs and indigenous knowledge systems.
Although, Bourdieu's perspective offers a bit of a reality check. Bourdieu would remind us that even these alternative initiatives still operate within a larger academic field, often dominated by Western symbolic capital. The struggle continues even within alternative spaces.
A good point. The academic field itself has power structures. Even challengers are influenced by the dominant norms and values.
Okay, next. Social movements as knowledge producers, creating their own epistemologies of resistance.
Right. Movements generate unique insights born from their struggles, challenging dominant understandings based on lived experience.
The Congreso Nacional Indígena, the CNI, is a key example.
The National Indigenous Congress, what kind of knowledge do they produce?
They document rights violations, environmental issues, using methods like talking maps.
Talking maps, community-created maps showing their history, their territory, their struggles.
Yeah, exactly. And they use community radio, like Radio Zapote, to get their stories out, bypassing mainstream media.
Those are compelling examples of communities developing their own tools to document reality, raise awareness, and challenge injustice from their own perspective.
And the community police forces in Guerrero, developing their own justice systems based on local customs because the state system failed them.
Another instance of movements generating alternative knowledge and practices in response to systemic failures, drawing on tradition and collective experience.
But drawing on Nancy Fraser, Beto Ramirez reminds us, movements aren't monolithic utopias.
Internal contradictions, power dynamics within the movement itself.
Yeah. He mentions Zapatista women raising concerns about machismo, or young migrants critiquing the CNI's perhaps idealized view of rural life.
Important reminder, movements need internal reflexivity, ongoing dialogue about their own power dynamics and potential exclusions. Self-critique is vital.
Then, the impact of neoliberal policies on knowledge production.
Ah, the market logic creeping into academia, privatization, competition.
Middle-Ringers explains how the SNI, the National Researcher System, incentivizes publishing in international journals, pursuing marketable research.
Right. Focusing on metrics that align with global competition, maybe at the expense of local relevance or critical inquiry.
And it shows. Statistics indicate more social science theses on entrepreneurship now compared to poverty or inequality.
That shift reflects neoliberal values influencing research agendas, doesn't it? Potentially diverting focus from pressing social problems.
But again, resistance. Collectives like the Red Mexicana de Estudios Críticos del Desarrollo.
The Mexican Network of Critical Development Studies.
Are promoting research with independent unions, social groups, advocating for open access publishing.
Pushing back against that marketization, prioritizing research for social justice, making knowledge accessible, not just a commodity. That's crucial.
This links to David Harvey's idea of the flexible accumulation of academic capital,
suggesting that even knowledge production gets integrated into the logic of capitalism with its own pressures and incentives.
Okay, now a really tough topic. Epistemic violence. The silencing and real danger faced by critical researchers in Mexico.
This is incredibly serious. The risks involved for those challenging power through their work.
The numbers are shocking. Between 2000 and 2023, 42 academics murdered. 60% of them were investigating narco links or corruption.
42 murdered? That's horrifying. And the Pegasus spyware scandal under Calderon, hundreds of researchers spied on.
It creates a climate of fear, doesn't it? Leads to self-censorship. Undermines academic freedom at its core.
Absolutely.
He specifically mentions Sergio Aguayo, targeted for his research on political organized crime links. A high-profile case.
Aguayo's case is a stark reminder of the dangers for those who bravely investigate powerful illicit networks.
And in response, you see groups like R3D creating secure research manuals, journals using pseudonyms.
Chilling necessities. They highlight the urgent need for better protection and solidarity for researchers working on dangerous topics, often at immense personal risk.
Finally, the geopolitics of knowledge, academic dependency.
The unequal global power relations in knowledge production. Mexico's reliance on theories and agendas from the global north.
Those statistics, again, 85% of theories cited are Euro-American. Only 2 out of 100 top Latin American journals are Mexican.
Stark illustration of the ongoing influence of Western thought and the relative lack of global recognition for Mexican scholarship, theoretical colonialism still.
But there are positive initiatives. The Catedra Jorge Alonso at UDG, systematizing non-extractive methods.
Right.
And publishers like Editorial Acapana, publishing in indigenous languages.
Important efforts to promote locally relevant research and amplify diverse voices and knowledge systems within Mexico itself. Steps towards intellectual decolonization.
And Metal Ramirez notes that ongoing debate between thinkers like Mignolo and Wallerstein.
About whether genuine dialogue with global academia is possible without just reproducing that subordinate position.
Yeah, it's a fundamental challenge. How to engage globally while maintaining intellectual autonomy.
A complex balancing act for scholars in the global South.
So the final takeaway from this whole sociopolitical landscape section.
Metal Ramirez paints Mexican social research as a contested space, doesn't he? A site of struggle.
Definitely. State and economic interests trying to shape the agenda.
While social movements create knowledge from resistance, and critical academics navigate that tricky path between co-option and resistance.
He calls for changes like citizen oversight of funding, protection networks for researchers.
And fundamentally rethinking how academic work is valued, prioritizing social relevance over just market metrics.
It really brings home that Zapatista phrase. Detrás de nosotros están ustedes. Behind us are you.
A powerful challenge to academics, isn't it? To align their work with struggles for justice.
Yeah. It highlights the deeply political nature of knowledge production. A call for researchers to be aware of the power dynamics and take a more critical, engaged, socially responsible stance.
Ultimately, contributing to a more just society, not just academic debate.
And that wraps up our deep dive into Carlos Metal Ramirez's work on absurd logic and counter-epistemologies. We've journeyed through the philosophy, the methods, the sociopolitics.
Hopefully giving you, our listener, a more critical, nuanced lens for understanding information and analysis coming out of Mexico.
Right. Moving beyond simple explanations, recognizing the complex factors, historical, political, methodological, that shape what we think we know.
Exactly.
And on that note, we leave you with that Zapatista challenge again. Detrás de nosotros están ustedes.
Makes you think about the role of knowledge in social struggle.
Hopefully it sparks some further thought and exploration for you. Thanks for diving deep with us today.